The date is September 13, 1983. This is the second lecture in a series of lectures by Roger Ware on the Enlightenment. Tonight's lecture is entitled Leibniz, 1646 to 1716, The Great Genius of the Movement, The Magusse Becomes Thinker. Tonight's lecture is part two of the Leibniz set. Last week was also on Leibniz.
I'm offering the lectures that should have gone in here on these Thursdays here at this location. And one of them is on Thanksgiving. So if you're not traditional and finicky about having meat with relatives, you can come and have vegetarian fare here with us. We'll have something here. We'll serve some food, fresh food. And the lecture to be special on Thanksgiving is going to be on Botticelli. In fact, it's going to be on Botticelli's Mythologies, which is the title of a paper done by E.H. Gombrich years ago for the Warburg Journal. And that should be of interest. Then the December 29th lecture, which is a holiday at PRS because it's, well, I guess because it's in between holidays. Well, I don't take off in between holidays either. I know a lot about continuity, and I don't do that sort of thing. So that lecture is going to be here too, because Stefan is of the same mind. We're willing to be ritual and even religious, but we're not willing to take holidays. So that lecture is going to be special, and it's going to be on Raphael, who is one of the better artists. And what I'm trying to do is get some kind of a blow-up or a print of the School of Athens by Raphael, so we can have something besides some slides, actually have something we can point to. But complementing that Italian Renaissance course, because I couldn't just work him in to the 11 dates or the 13 dates, I couldn't do that to him. So we're making a special lecture on Michelangelo on a Saturday morning, which is November 19th, which probably in some tradition is a holiday, but we'll be there. And so altogether there'll be 14 presentations on the Italian Renaissance.
Saturday, November the what?
19th. Anyway, these...
That's a Swedish holiday.
Santa Lucia Day, with the candles around the heads, the sweet little girls.
Is that going to be in the morning?
Yeah, plenty of time to find out. Plenty of time to find out. I'll handle it. We've been offering Saturday morning classes because we've been starting a school. And the school has been coming along, and we started off in a Chinese Buddhist temple over in the Highland Park area. And circumstances being what they are in this world nudged us all the way into a condition where we have our own building. And circumstances turned out so that the building was actually purchased by an interested group, and we're going to have that pretty soon. So our Saturday morning classes are going to be held over on Hyperion. That's exactly 1 mile from here. It's exactly 1 mile from PRS. Oddly enough, it's a halfway in between if you took the long way around. And because that situation there, as Alfred North Whitehead would say, because that event has a stable spin, we can count on continuity there for a very long time in terms of decades. So what we're going to do is reinstate the entire interdisciplinary program that I offered in San Francisco and in Canada. And that program operates on 8 different levels, and there are possibilities of having several courses, in fact, in some levels, many courses, but the 8 different levels were thought through and experimented through to be a way to bring anyone from wherever they are into a comprehensive mode of being able to be free to explore anything they want on any level they want. So instead of getting a degree, you have capacity, freedom. And so these 8 levels will be offered. It takes 2 years to go through the cycle on a quarterly basis. And I'll just do that. But because the introductory level is so comprehensive and really opens up the possibilities, that will be offered quite frequently, perhaps every quarter. Because of the nature of the introductory level, I divided it into complements. And so those 2 courses will be offered starting in October on Saturday mornings over at our Hyperion address. We'll have all sorts of things. When you finish these courses, you can take these courses plus the tax and so forth and go to almost any school you want to, and they'll give you credit. Among other things, I have a life teaching credential in California on any level you wish. But these 2 courses are complementary. One of them deals with symbols and symbolic consciousness. And when I offered it at UCLA in 1975, I appended as part of the title, so it was descriptively accurate, Symbolic Consciousness and Contemporary Mythic Man. In fact, that's how I met Stefan Heller. He was teaching his course on the 7 Sermons to the Dead just down the hall. And Kai D was directly across the hall with a course in the I Ching, the very populous hallway at that time. All the weirdos at UCLA were there. I remember getting a glimpse of the janitor coming in late, always late getting out. And he was looking at the blackboard and sort of taking in what was there, and I'm sure that he was shaking his head. But the first course then is Symbolic Consciousness and Contemporary Mythic Man, and to go with that is a course called Nature. But it's nature as we find it in 1983 in the scientific mode. And I'm going to have in the Nature course 5 books which will span like the fingers of a hand, very briefly, what we're doing in terms of thinking about nature in 1983. One of the volumes that I'm going to use in that course is going to be the Norton Critical Edition of the Double Helix, the book about the discovery of DNA, with all of the reviews of it, the refutations of it, the support of it. This is a critical volume. It not only has the book, the Double Helix, but many other things. Another volume in this will be Timothy Ferris's great book on galaxies, Contemporary Astronomy. And Richard Leakey's book on origins is going to be there also. So we'll have a series of 5 books in that. In the symbols course, one of the texts will be Carl Jung's Mandala Symbolism. And there'll be some other volumes. Next week, when I have everything in a printed form, I will bring in specimens of all of the texts so you can take a look and see. Those courses will probably run $5 a course per, $5 a class per session. And I think it'll be well worth it. Then in January, we'll go into the second level, which will be mythology. And then the third and fourth and so on, we'll have all the different levels. So the eight-level program over a series of 2 years, I ran it for 2 or 3, 2.5 years in San Francisco area and 5 years in Canada, and put more than 12 or 1,300 students through it. And the only thing you have to do is to come continuously. Your continuity of being there will fit into the pattern that is there, and it really produces a change. Really produces a change. Many people observed you don't have to have any therapy. All you have to do is get some kind of a locus in your own confidence about your mobility in terms of feeling and ideas. Get your image base onto the horizon of your own curiosity, and you can just go. You can explore. And the final level, the eighth level, is called explorations. So that whole thing is developing and is there. So we've got all kinds of programs. We're going to have a number of basic, universal classes there. Now, starting in October, we're going to have a course on Chinese language and thought. And we're going to have a course on the Byzantine world with a little bit of Greek language. So we're coming in with the two classic modes, East and West, right away. And then we'll develop all these things so that by January, the offering should be spread out. For January, there are already three ladies working up some material to fit into a course called Mythological Dance, which will have 12 presentations of the mythological dance from around the world in different times. And you will actually make costumes and actually make masks and actually learn some steps along with the rituals behind and so forth. So this is going to be a real full experience, real choice, full experience. We're going to start off with a library of about 10,000 volumes, hand-picked, no junk, no duplicates, and it's going to be in a home sort of situation where you can go in, you can have your tea, you can have your situation of comfort. You won't be able to take the books out, but you'll be able to read them in comfort during days and evenings and weekends. In other words, it's going to be really there, available for your use and your edification on a very fine level. So we've got all of that in motion and operating. Well, we technically begin tonight on the Enlightenment. But those who know me know I don't take any holidays, and that just because the program doesn't list a lecture, I don't miss. I've never missed a lecture. I don't seem to get ill even. So if you're coming on Tuesdays or Thursdays or Saturdays, you can count on there being something whether it's announced or not. Trithemius used to teach 3 times a week, and he did that for a long time. And I was brought up in that tradition. So it's just a constant, and it's no effort for me because it's just something I do. Last week was the second lecture on Leibniz that we've had, so tonight will be the third. And we have just begun to scratch the possibilities of the genius of Leibniz. In the 1970s, Leibniz was rediscovered all over again. and the books and essays proliferate. I just bought a book, a collection of critical essays published by the University of Minnesota Press on Leibniz. And the bibliography in there was easily three or four times that of a book which had come out in the mid-1970s. So just in the last 8 years, articles proliferate on Leibniz. One of the reasons is because he is a real precursor, a real forerunner of Einstein. Even though he's separated by 250 or 300 years, he was the first person to understand relativity. Now we have a nice little volume here by a great philosopher of science, Hans Reichenbach, From Copernicus to Einstein. And he will say in here, right, on page 120, Einstein's conception of gravitation as a metric power, as a force determining the relations of spatial measurement, leads therefore to a far-reaching revolution in our knowledge of space. Apart from the novelty of the theory of a limited heavenly space, which signifies a turning point similar to that of the doctrine of the spherical shape of the Earth, at the time of its promulgation, the method of dealing with the problem of space applied in Einstein's theory represents a new form of philosophic thinking. There are times when man achieves not just a new idea, but a new form to his thought. That was the revolution wrought by Plato and by Leibniz and by Einstein. The forms of thought changed. Not now. Further writes Reichenbach, it follows the principle that statements concerning space are not to be separated from statements concerning bodies in space, that a space has no absolute significance apart from things and the laws of their mutual relations. A principle recognized before Einstein only by Leibniz. Now all this is available, and I want to bring you very quickly in. At the end of this great volume, edited by Lohmke, originally published by the University of Chicago Press, reprinted and revised a little bit, expanded in the Netherlands, Lohmke gives us a wonderful selection of Leibniz's writings and a series of correspondence between Leibniz and Newton, ostensibly between Leibniz and a man named Clark, but Clark writing for Newton. Leibniz died as the series was in progress, and he wrote a series of four or five letters and received four or five replies. In Leibniz's third paper, they are talking about space, and he has been arguing by correspondence with Newton through Clark about the fact that Newton seems to conceive of space as a thing, as an organ of God's activity at the best. He has taken him to task, and several times Leibniz has been corrected and reprimanded. So now Leibniz, in his third letter, writes, "These gentlemen maintain, therefore, that space is a real absolute being. But this involves them in great difficulties. For such a being must needs be eternal and infinite. Hence, some have believed it to be God himself, or one of his attributes, his immensity. But since space consists of parts, it is not a thing which can belong to God. As for my own opinion, I have said more than once that I hold space to be something merely relative, as time is. That I hold it to be an order of coexistences, as time is an order of successions. Space is an order of simultaneity, and time is an order of succession. For space denotes, in terms of possibility, an order of things which exist at the same time, considered as existing together, without inquiring into their particular manner of existing. And when many things are seen together, one perceives that order of things among themselves. I have had many demonstrations to confute the fancy of those who take space to be a substance, or at least an absolute being. And then he goes on and he will give more examples. This was near the very end of his life in 1716, when he was age 70. Now, to get to that comprehensiveness of why a great philosopher of science like Reichenbach, writing about Einstein, is able to single out one single precursor, Leibniz, and why at the end of his life, Leibniz restating to Newton again, for the umpteenth time, the fact that there was a basic change in thought formation which he was responsible for, which Newton, with all of his genius, and Leibniz heralded Newton as one of those giants of thought that made the age, but that he would not realize that the forms of thought had changed, and therefore the universe was different. Man had grown up in a very fundamentally real way. The only way to understand this is to think back in your minds when most of you were attending the series on the origins of Hermetic science, and you saw that the development of the Renaissance Neoplatonic tradition through Ficino and Pico, and through Trithemius and Colette and so forth, on through Bruno and Dee, on through Bacon, and up into the hands of Leibniz and Newton, that it was Leibniz who inherited the European, the continental Hermetic tradition. In a very real way, Leibniz is a cosmic revolutionary, whereas Isaac Newton was an individualist in the British tradition who was seeking to be a private mind at work, and Leibniz, with his responsibilities of caring for the tradition, felt that he had to not only come up with a view which was integrative of all the elements of life, but further, a universal language which could describe the workings of this focus, this integrative capacity of man's realization. And third, that it should apply to all areas of life, that there should not be any area of man's endeavor that was free from application. So that in Leibniz's writings, he is constantly interested in a unified Europe with all the kingdoms brought together. He was interested in world peace. He was interested in the economic situation. All of these along with the tremendous philosophic correspondence and publication which he took upon himself. Now, most of this material is still in the archives at Hanover. Only about a third of Leibniz's writings have ever been published in any language. He wrote extensively in French and Latin, as well as in German. He was in correspondence with almost every major mind of his time. He, as a young man, had corresponded with Thomas Hobbes in England as an old man. He had met in Paris Malebranche and Huygens, the Dutch mathematician. He had gone to England and had met Robert Boyle. He, of course, was very close to Newton in correspondence. Over a lifetime, he had talked extensively to Spinoza. He was just simply in contact with everybody. But he was also the grandson of a Leibniz who had appeared upon the list of Johann Valentin Andreas Societas Christianas, which was the core membership responsible for the Rosicrucian movement in the early 17th century. So that the declarations of universal revolution that were declared in the Fama and Confessio of the Rosicrucians find their answer and their echoing in the works of Leibniz at the end of the same century. And the grandson becomes, at the age of 20, as he is receiving his doctorate, an initiate in Nuremberg in the Rosicrucian Society. Now this, of course, comes as a surprise to some individuals, seems irrelevant to other individuals, but in Lohmkerr, we read here, in Nuremberg, however, a center in which the new sciences were beginning to flourish and where he himself was inducted into the Rosicrucian Society, his mind seems to have teemed with projects to be achieved at courts, not in universities. Projects for the reform of law and of education, for academies, libraries, for advancing science, for the strategy of European politics. All of this familiar to us now because it was the range of interest for those hermetic individuals seeking to change the conditions under which man would live. That the very programs which Bacon outlined in his tracts was actually brought into possibility by Leibniz's writings. Now it is quite possible in this to make a mistake and to think of Leibniz as simply some philosopher in a tradition like one would take a course on Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz and call it Philosophy 10. This is absolutely an inane way to look at this situation. Leibniz himself becomes distorted and many times has been shunted into the background of university courses. The reason that he was interested in having a position at courts is because it was there as the advisor to those powerful individuals whose courts they were, that the world could actually be changed, that conditions could be engendered. And we find that having served his apprenticeship in his 20s, at the age of 30, Leibniz was appointed for life, the last 40 years of his life, as the librarian of the House of Brunswick. And if you were here for the Hermetic Science course, you know that the great European mastermind for the Rosicrucian movement all through the early 17th century up to the 18th century was the Duke of Brunswick, named Augustus. And Duke Augustus of Brunswick, who lived up until Leibniz was 20 years of age. So that we have a number of connections which lead us to expect then that the programs that Leibniz was working upon and writing upon, he expected could be implemented. He was in fact convinced all through his lifetime, from a little boy, his father, who was a professor of jurisprudence in Leipzig, died when Leibniz was only 6, but Leibniz, even as a little boy, was already showing the promise that he had. He spent his entire life as a secular monk in this hermetic tradition, thinking that the new age was in fact about to dawn and that he would, because of the incredible focus of events leading to him, that he had the responsibility to carry the thought, the lighted torch of understanding, once he had achieved his universal language, universal characteristic, he called it, a symbolic characteristic that would be true for all time under any conditions, wherever he would carry this torch of freedom and liberation for man's mind, he sought to illuminate the beginnings of whole branches of endeavor, whole new sciences, and so forth. It is a peculiarity of history that, in fact, Leibniz was the right man at the right place at the right time, but that the Duke of Brunswick, who inherited the tradition, was a boar named George I, who became, in fact, the uniter of Germany and England in a very real way. The House of Hanover took over, was invited in, and became the royal lineage of England, and what would have been the grand finale ended up by having George I consider Leibniz troublesome and left him alone in anonymity in Hanover to pace his final years alone with very little support at all. So we have an anomaly here. What sustained Leibniz for the 35 or 38 years was not so much the male lineage in the House of Brunswick, but the female lineage. And in fact, his great patron was the Electress Sophia. And it was Sophia and her daughter, who later became the first Queen of Prussia, Charlotte Sophia, who loved Leibniz's mind, his ideas, the tremendous manliness with which he accepted a responsibility that was at once esoteric in its integration and exoteric in its responsibilities for the entire form of the world. And until the Electress Sophia died, Leibniz was cared for, and he had every expectation that eventually they would be put into effect. And so when he was helping to found the Academy in Berlin and the Academy in Vienna and academies all over Europe, Leibniz was thinking in his mind that these were lights going on a Christmas tree that would illuminate all of a united Europe, because there would be an intellectual understanding, regardless of nationality, regardless of language, regardless of lineage, because all the roads led to the same enormous integration of ideas in a universal language, which he assiduously worked all his lifetime on to perfect. And remember now, it is Leibniz's notation that we use, basically, in the differential calculus and not Newton's. He felt that by having a language which was truthful, which anyone could learn according to laws and principles of thought and reason, would have then matured to the point, having learned that language, that they would be able to understand that someone else knowing that language also had matured to that point, and that reason then could speak clearly above the various traditions of Europe and unify the continent, unify the mind of Western man. And in fact, though it did not happen the way Leibniz probably expected it to happen, it happened in fact in that most unusual of centuries called the Enlightenment, where individuals by themselves assumed that there was an intellectual audience across Europe to pay attention to their discoveries and their writings, and that is why we begin with Leibniz. The Enlightenment becomes less understandable, in fact becomes just another cultural epoch, history 12b, instead of the fantastic illumination that happened at that time. And of course, because the Enlightenment had a very real effect, energizing the dreams and the visions of people, towards the end of the Enlightenment, we find that the gentlemanly correspondence between intellectual equals becomes a little frayed at the edges, and in its place comes a new generation that say, enough talk, let's do something. And out of that comes the American Revolution, the French Revolution, William Blake, and the whole development of Kant's great idealism, Mozart's symphonies, Shelley's great poetry, Napoleon, the whole Jefferson, the entire revolution of thought happens because finally the message of Leibniz comes across. And nowhere do we find the most poignant confirmation of this. Leibniz, in order to try in his time to convince Louis XIV not to scramble up Europe again in another 30 years' war, not to invade the Dutch, not to invade the Netherlands, to in fact direct his energies to Egypt. And these writings of Leibniz, which were ignored by Louis XIV, he probably never saw them, but they were read by another Frenchman named Bonaparte. And he went to Egypt and he did exactly what Leibniz had recommended. And in one of his letters to one of his generals, he calls the bon vivant, the great celebrity, Leibniz for having had this beautiful idea. So we're beginning with Leibniz for all of these reasons. And as I pointed out last week, if you take a standard good history of the Enlightenment, like Peter Gay's book, The Enlightenment, subentitled The Rise of the New Paganism, you find very little mention of Leibniz in it. But if you read his acknowledgments and the first 5 or 6 pages of his 100-page bibliography annotated, he says all of his insights come from Ernst Cassirer, and Ernst Cassirer's great book on the Enlightenment. And when we brought forth Ernst Cassirer's book on the Enlightenment, it was dominated by Leibniz. And Cassirer himself, as you can hear on the tape, I went into it to some extent, also locates in Leibniz the taproot of the Enlightenment, just as Reichenbach will do in our own time.
Why not expect that to be just a coincidence?
I don't wish to go into these kinds of, I'm composing in my mind.
I'm sorry, I was looking for the point.
Yeah, I'm trying to compose as I'm here, and I'm holding in suspension an array of things that you don't see, but I see them intellectually. And I'm trying to pick and choose fresh, as it were, to give you what I'm thinking of immediately. I'm glad after the lecture is over just to go into question after question at your leisure, if I may. A small helpful guide to Leibniz, and because his range is so great, you really need to have some little guide. This tiny little book here, just a little more than 100 pages or so, by a man named C.A. Van Pursen, just called Leibniz, A Guide to His Philosophy, published by Dutton Paperbacks. I saw a used copy at the Bodie Tree for 70 cents. Wisdom in our time is laying in the streets, if not gasping for air, at least willing to be picked up and given a home. He begins with an interesting quotation series from Leibniz to try and place the man in his own estimation. Leibniz writing, quoted by Van Pursen, "I flatter myself with the thought that by dint of following in the tracks of Plato and other men, I have learnt something from them and have reached in one point at any rate the serene temples erected by the teachings of the wise. These rise upon a foundation of general truths which do not depend on facts, and yet, as I see it, form the key to the knowledge which passes judgment on the fact." So he's lifting the vision up. We call that transcendental, but for Leibniz, he would call that real in a formal way. "I have always endeavored to expose the truth that lies buried and dispersed beneath the notions of the various philosophic schools and to bring it into harmony with itself." One of the primordial nodes in Leibniz's thought is that there is a harmony, a harmonia. Not only a harmonia mundi, but a harmonia supramundi. There is a harmony. And the difficulty with that harmony of the universe, if you wish to think of it that way, is that it is infinite in many respects to man's perspective. And in his own time, Descartes had singled out that this fact alone seemed to cage man and put a real ceiling on his intellectual ambition, not only on his accomplishments, but what he could hope to entertain intellectually. And Leibniz, taking the cue because he was the champion on the field of the time, responsible for these issues, he took them that seriously, brought out the fact that we do not have to have a complete index to the infinite to have a handle upon understanding, that as long as we have a pattern which holds in its continuity for a reasonable duration of that unity, that is sufficient, because then we will have some way of having a measurable perspective which we can apply infinitely then and learn along the way whatever there is to learn in that voyage to the infinite. And this, of course, was the change that was brought about in the infinitesimal calculus. One of the primordial problems was, one could talk about straight lines, one could talk about circles, but these odd-shaped curves, what could one do besides have a series of triangulations and then have to shuffle those triangles into some sort of order and succession? Leibniz set all of that activity aside and gave, for the first time, a way to follow the movement, the durational movement of the line curve as it formed. So that if you have, say, the curve made by a chain suspended between two points,